expectation and hope is that this will be closing down sooner than later. But Israel has a right to defend itself when you have thousands of rockets flying into your territory. But I had a conversation for a while with the Prime Minister of Israel, and I think that my hope is that we'll see this coming to conclusion sooner than later.
President Biden yesterday addressing the violence that's erupted in the Gaza Strip and Israel. For days now, Palestinians have fired rockets toward Israel. And Israeli airstrikes in Gaza yesterday led to the collapse of this 14-story building that reportedly housed a TV station run by Hamas. Civilians have been killed, as you'll hear from this Palestinian man standing near the burned-out wreckage of a small car in Gaza. He says was hit by an Israeli airstrike.
What should I say? This is a crime. They were civilians, a woman, her children, a barber, and a shop owner. These are the people who were at the scene. They didn't hit a militant or a leader. We were civilians sleeping in our homes.
Further inland, in the town of Lod, halfway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, street violence broke out, says this rabbi, Avraham Sagron.
We had a nightmare of a night, really a riot of hundreds of Arab youths. They came in masses, torched car after car, trash bins, broke windows, and it was really dangerous to leave the house.
Israeli and Palestinian political leaders haven't made much of an effort to tone down the rhetoric either. Here's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yesterday, I told those sons of darkness, the Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists, that their blood is forfeit. And this is just the beginning. We'll hit them like they've never dreamed possible.
And here is Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas.
I direct my speech specifically to America and Israel. We are fed up. Go away from us. Leave us. We will stay like a thorn in your eyes. We will never leave our country. End your occupation today before tomorrow.
So what is going on? How did all this start? And can the violence be toned down? Or are we seeing the start of a third intifada? We're going to talk about this now with Zach Beauchamp, senior correspondent for Vox and host of the Worldly podcast. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, it's been 4 days now, and the violence just seems to be getting worse, as we just heard, with clashes on the streets of some Israeli cities. Is that new, to see these clashes so violent and so long-lasting on the streets now?
So yes and no. It's important to put this in historical context, right? There have been riots targeting civilians before inside Israel's borders. I'm sorry. You saw that both in the run-up to Israeli independence and the fighting surrounding the formation of the state. You also saw it, among other times, in 2000 during the second Intifada, 2000-2001, that time period. There were notable instances of street violence. But since then, no. This is a genuinely novel phenomenon for the past 20 years, even the last three major Gaza wars in 2008, 2009, 2011, and 2014 had nothing like this going on. So it is a real shock to observers of the region and citizens of Israel alike.
Right. And so when you look at, for instance, that city of Lod, that's a mixed Jewish and Arab city. So you have Arab Israelis clashing with Orthodox Jews. And that exemplifies what you're talking about as a relatively new phenomenon.
That's right. The violence in Lod and in other places, so Bat Yam is a suburb south of Tel Aviv, where there was footage on Israeli television last night. It's truly chilling stuff. The reporters filmed a Jewish mob beating a man that they thought was an Arab. I believe he did turn out to be, but it's very hard to tell because a lot of the Jews in Israel are of Arabic descent, with an Israeli flag. And there, of course, there had been riots going the other way as well in different places. It speaks to a degree of, I want to say, unraveling of Israeli civil society in the past few years. You know, there's been incredibly divisive political campaigns waged in 2019. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tried to turn out his base by warning that Arabs were going to the polls, quote unquote, in droves. And that kind of language of pitting the Jewish minority against the Arab minority has served both to inflame prejudices held among the Jewish population against the Arabs, and deepen the Arab sense of isolation for Arab citizens of Israel. And what we're seeing right now appears to be some kind of uncorking of this horrific tension that had been stoked and built up by members of the Israeli elite for the past few years now.
Well, let's talk about Netanyahu. What does it mean for him? Because he did look like he was skating on thin political ice after five terms in office and four elections in the last 2 years. It looked like he was on his way out. Now, does this actually strengthen him?
So the ironic thing is this awful situation that he bears significant responsibility for appears to be redounding to his political benefit. The reason why is that the opposition was at the time, before the fighting started, trying to come up with some kind of broad front coalition to get to 61 votes, a majority in the Knesset, which is necessary to form a government in the Israeli system. And those factions were a really ideologically diverse set. On the far right, you had Naftali Bennett, who is the leader of a party that represents, broadly speaking, the Israeli religious nationalist and settler movement. And then you had, you know, parties on the relative left of Israel's political spectrum, like Meretz, which is the Peace Party. And crucially, you needed to get some votes from an Arab party, Ra'am, which is an Arab Islamist party. And so you were going to have this really huge coalition united by nothing other than hatred of Netanyahu and a sense that he was doing damage to Israel's democracy. But now with the rioting, you're starting to see Bennett, who was a crucial part of this, say that we can't really be in coalition with an Arab government. It doesn't seem like the right thing to do. I personally find this counterintuitive. You'd think that this would exactly be the time when you'd want to have a unity government in Israel. But that was what Bennett said behind closed doors today. Ra'am is still saying it's interested in some kind of coalition agreement. But as of right now, Bennett is negotiating with Netanyahu again, even though he didn't want to join a Netanyahu government. It's all very confusing, but it seems like the intercommunal violence is redounding to the benefit of the Israeli right.
And so what about on the opposite side with Hamas? Are they strengthened as well?
Yes, there's a tendency when it comes to Israel-Palestine violence that only the extremists benefit and the moderates tend to suffer. And that's a historical pattern, and it seems to be playing out here. So this didn't have to happen, right? This all started because of a series of clashes in Jerusalem that they had many, many different causes, very complicated, but it didn't need to escalate to war. Hamas, the Palestinian militants, made a decision to fire rockets on Jerusalem, which crossed what Israel referred to as a red line. That led to violent reprisal from the Israelis because they said, you can't fire rockets at Jerusalem. Now, why did Hamas do this? It seems that they thought that it would give them an ability to capitalize politically on dissent among the Palestinian population with the way Israel was handling Jerusalem and with the overall state of Palestinian politics, where there hadn't been a lot of votes.
Right. Well, meanwhile, President Biden has been criticized for acting too slowly. He hasn't even named an ambassador to Israel yet. And so are they trying to broker a ceasefire?
It's hard to tell what the Biden government is doing right now. It doesn't seem like it's a very intensive hands-on effort. They have made some noises about trying to broker a ceasefire, but typically the party that does ceasefire brokering in these contexts is Egypt. They take the lead because Egypt also controls, they control the other border to Gaza that Israel doesn't control. And so there's always, Egypt can sort of be a mediator between the two sides, neither fully weighted towards Israel nor Hamas. And since the U.S. doesn't negotiate with Hamas, Israel can use Egypt as a proxy to reach out to these people. What the U.S. is doing is taking a, surprisingly to me anyway, pro-Israel position, not surprising in the long arc of American foreign policy, but surprising in the sense that the Democratic Party has shifted very much to the left on Israel-Palestine, has become markedly more sympathetic to the Palestinian position on the conflict, not to Hamas exactly. It's not like Democrats are sympathizing with an outright terrorist group, but rather as seeing the continued existence of the conflict is primarily Israeli responsibility and the violence the result of Israel's policies, I would say, sort of becoming more and more mainstream position in the party.
Yeah. meaning the violence appears to be ongoing and will continue to occur. Zach Beauchamp, senior correspondent for Vox and host of the Worldly podcast. Zach, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Coming up, how to end gun violence in this country. I'll speak with one of the Parkland High School students who became a gun control activist and the director of a new documentary about those kids. The movie is called Us Kids, and that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A striking headline from CNN this week. There were at least 10 mass shootings across the U.S. this weekend. That was the headline. The pandemic and last year's racial justice protests made it easy to forget just how much gun violence there is in our country. And now it feels it is roaring back, reminiscent of a moment in late 2017, early 2018, when we saw three of the deadliest mass shootings in U.S. history, Las Vegas, Texas, and on Valentine's Day, 2018, Parkland. 17 people were killed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in South Florida. It was easy to feel despondent about what was happening, all this gun violence. But after Parkland, something felt different, and it was because of the students.
They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS! They say that no laws could have been able to prevent the hundreds of senseless tragedies that have occurred. We call BS! That us kids don't know what we're talking about, that we're too young to understand how the government works. We call BS!
Us Kids is the name of a new documentary that follows those survivors turned gun control activists who founded the March for Our Lives movement. It's directed by Kim A. Snyder. She won a Peabody Award for her 2016 documentary, Newtown, about the aftermath of the Sandy Hook shooting. Welcome to Press Play, Kim.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Sam Fuentes. She's a Parkland survivor and activist who is featured in the documentary. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Well, let's begin with you. You were shot in the legs, wounded by shrapnel in your face. And I don't want to ask you to relive that day, but I do want to play a clip of tape from the opening scene of the movie.
Before all of this, like, we were normal ass kids doing normal ass things. At first, I didn't want to acknowledge what had happened to me. But there was this part of me that kept wanting to, like, say it over and over and over again. But not because I wanted it to feel real, but because I wanted to feel less real, to a point where it becomes a story opposed to, like, my life.
Sam, so that's you in the documentary. Is it your life? Is it still your life?
I like to think so. I think a symptom of going through a traumatic experience like this is that you tend to kind of dissociate yourself from it and derealize a bit because the content, I guess, is just so traumatic. And, you know, at many times I felt like almost like a character in a larger story instead of, you know, a victim of this, you know, terrible atrocity. And I think it was just because it was easier for me to process, because then it wasn't like my trauma, right? It was this person's trauma. And so I think one thing about this film is that you kind of see what actualizing is for me. And that was not just becoming an activist, but working alongside people who have experienced that kind of trauma. And a part of taking my life back and reorienting myself into my own life, I suppose, was, you know, kind of giving myself a sense of power and control.
And Kim, I suppose that's a similar feeling that the other kids in the documentary felt as well, that by becoming activists, it felt good. It felt good to take that power, to take that control back in the face of something in which you felt completely powerless and out of control, to feel better, to somehow heal through activism.
I wouldn't want to, you know, speak for them, but I think it's something I have observed having made the Newtown movie, those were adults, but I think it's rare. I've met so many survivors of gun violence now, and it seems a real hallmark in a way that for many people like Sam, to, as she said, reclaim your narrative is to find purpose. And, you know, there's a line in the movie you say, Sam, that you wouldn't feel whole if you weren't doing something about the fact that your friend was murdered next to you. And it reminded me a lot of what we thought about or experienced for those of us people who are older in the Vietnam era, you know, people who were fallen and killed and needlessly in many cases.
Right. And around the same age, I suppose, maybe a few years older, but this is an age where teenagers are forming intense bonds with each other and treating their friends like family in a sense. And Sam, can you talk about, I mean, you talk about your friend Nick, who was right next to you. He was a swimmer. He wanted to go to the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. And he was incredibly important to you. And is he the main reason why you became an activist on this issue?
Absolutely. I think Nick more specifically had an influence in my life, especially because, you know, of the location in which I was when he passed, and just having known him probably the longest and probably the most out of everybody since I was a freshman in high school. You know, it's just, there's something very telling about the person he was, and he was just an incredibly hard worker, and he was passionate about the things that he did, and he put all of his energy and all of his planning and into the things that he cared deeply about. And that wasn't just swimming, that was his family, that was his friends, and he was just a generous and giving guy all around. And, you know, that selflessness was something that I wanted to embody, you know, this idea that this was hopefully what he would want out of anything that I could do for him, is fight against that form of injustice that affected him, you know? And I think it's one of those things that is really hard to articulate at times, but I guess the easiest way to say it is like, I don't quite see a life that I can live that doesn't involve constantly recounting this situation. You know, for the rest of my life, I'll be, you know, affected by the symptoms of PTSD and depression and anxiety, and I'll have to encounter all new triggers down the road and all these kinds of things. And so I think the only logical way to combat that was just to work really, really hard at it. And that's something that I guess, you know, Nick also embodied as a person. And so I suppose that's how I memorialize him and how I memorialize all the people who've lost those to gun violence. It's a really sad and close-knit group that we're all in, but we all have a reason why we do it. Like, it's very rare that I meet a fellow activist and they don't have a story for themselves.
And so many of you coalesced during that famous March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. This was March 24, 2018. It came about just 6 weeks after the shooting. And I just want to play a clip of you, Sam, again. Here you are on stage in Washington.
The moment we speak up, we're scolded that we are not old enough. It is as if we need permission to ask our friends not to die. Lawmakers and politicians will scream guns are not the issue, but can't look me in the eye. I just threw up on international television and it feels great.
And so during the movie, you narrate that you were sensing a feeling of fear, not fear of speaking in front of the crowd necessarily, but a fear that there might be a shooter in the audience, and that's why you vomited on stage.
Yeah, precisely. That was something that I hadn't anticipated, as you might imagine. My goal was, you know, to do a good job and say what my piece and and walk off the stage. And that's the unfortunate thing about PTSD, is that it sneaks up on you in the unkindest of moments, you know? And that's a reality that victims of gun violence face, is that once they have a situation in which their life is endangered, it is easy for them to believe that the rest of their life is at question and at risk. You know, I go out into public situations and I find myself questioning people's intentions and their body language and the small or largeness of a crowd, and checking for exits and looking for escape routes. And, you know, these are not things that you would assume a 20-something year old kid should be worrying about, but that's just it. That's my reality. And I think that just proves a further point of, this is the kind of people we have fighting on the forefront of this movement. And it's both a wonderful thing and also a terrible thing, because, and not to devalue my own work, but there are hundreds and thousands and millions of people who are far more able-bodied and well-off than I am, and have far more energy and time and less trauma that hasn't been affected by the actual thing that they're fighting against. And I suppose the word's not guilt, but just having to show the reality of the people, the kids who are literally fighting against this injustice, and how we really need more people, you know, supporting us and being there, not just a bystander, not just an audience member, but someone who really invokes real change in meaningful ways. So, and I, you know, you as helpful it is to have representation, it's also really saddening to think that we're asking a bunch of kids to be the strong ones, you know, where you're asking these group of traumatized kids to push their grief and their trauma aside to fight for something that at times we feel like people don't give a damn about.
It does feel that way when you see these mass shootings happen over and over and over and over again. And I guess I'm wondering, Kim, how do these kids in your movie, how do they see that now? They see that they were full of righteous anger right after their shooting and went and just marched and protested and organized and just worked ceaselessly. Do they see it as something that has brought about tangible results?
Yeah, Sam and I actually talk about this, and, you know, we've spent actually a lot more time since the completion of the film last year. But I think on one hand, I feel hopeful that, oddly enough, and Sam, please correct me, but I keep asking this question, is, you know, as these numbers just keep happening and we become numb, because you can't help it. You can't, how can you possibly take in the number you said at the beginning of this show? The public's becoming inured, and each time almost more numb, but I'm not sure kids are. I feel like they become maybe more angry and more traumatized. Yeah. So I just wonder about that divide in the generations, if they don't have the luxury of becoming numb in that way. I don't know what you think about that, Sam.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, people like myself don't have the privilege of not living in fear. And I have hope that the future is going to be a brighter and a more just and a safer one. But that's when we start recognizing the totality, you know, understanding how we combat gun violence starts with confronting the issues we already have hand. When it comes to things like mental health resources and therapy, these are things that are so undervalued in our system. And I think the biggest way that we can combat that is by presenting real objective truth and stories by and from gun violence survivors. So that's where my hope lies.
Are you as optimistic, Kim?
I mean, I have hope in, Sam, and it's horrible, but, you know, what Sam's articulating is that change out of crisis, it's built on fury and it's built on trauma, and these kids and people who've lost people, they don't quit. I mean, they don't really have a choice. So it's relentless. It's a lifetime work. And we all know that movements take time. So I do think the conversation changed in some ways after Newtown, and I certainly think it changed after Parkland. So I don't want to sound Pollyanna. I think it's maddening, but I have hope in Gen Z and this generation of kids that are, you know, that are looking up to role models like Sam and others. And I just have met hundreds and hundreds of Sams and Davids and other kids in my film. So that gives me hope.
Okay. Kim A. Snyder, her new documentary is called Us Kids. It's in theaters and on demand this Friday. And it features Sam Fuentes, a Parkland survivor and March for Our Lives activist. Sam and Kim, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Well, speaking of the future, this is KCRW's Drive to the Future, our semi-annual fundraising drive, where we're really looking towards a more hopeful, brighter future now that it looks like a lot of people are getting vaccinated and infections and deaths are waning in this country. So that is such a great thing. And we want to celebrate with you together. So won't you join and become a member and support us in what we do for you, bringing you these important stories, bringing you the fantastic music throughout the day, just being a full service radio station. You're also eligible to win a new iPhone 12. So there's a little bit of incentive if you donate today at kcrw.com. Pick up a thank you gift, and we do indeed thank you because we cannot do it without you. kcrw.com/give. Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews a day early, including a pan of Angelina Jolie's latest.
You're trying to convince me that Tyler Perry is the leader of these hitmen who's in all of one scene that lasts for a minute and a half. It was totally laughable.
Film reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. KCRW is airing special programming for NPR's 50th birthday during our noon hour tomorrow. So we, Press Play, we have the day off. We still want to talk about this weekend's new films, though. So let's do that a day early with Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International and the author of the book, This Is How You Make a Movie. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Madeline.
And Sean Edwards, film critic and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. Well, let's begin with Spiral. This is a horror film and the ninth in the Saw film series. And this one follows a rookie detective and his veteran partner, played by Chris Rock, as they investigate a murder case. And here's a bit from the trailer.
What do you got there?
Oh, it's just my wife, Emma. This is my son, Charlie.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
While it lasts?
Nothing happier than the wife of a new detective.
All available units, officer down.
Whoever did this has another motive. They're targeting cops.
Okay, Sean, what happens next? Mayhem?
Yes and no, because here's the deal. You know, if you thought that the Saw franchise had run its course, and you have to think again, it's very popular. So yes, they're going to keep making these movies. And like you mentioned, it's the ninth installment. And it was pretty much jump-started by Chris Rock, who actually executive produced the movie and stars in the movie as a police detective. Now he's trying to figure out why his colleagues are being mutilated. Unfortunately, it doesn't always add up. But nonetheless, here's the thing. Chris Rock is ruthlessly engaging. He plays this sort of veteran legacy cop, and he's actually deliciously entertaining as he does it. Now, he doesn't really speak very naturally because all his lines are dialogue or delivered in sort of this combo of bits from his stand-up routine. And they sort of sound like and have the cadence of old school rap lyrics. And I just wish the entire movie would have just focused on him. It didn't need all the stupid Saw stuff. I mean, it doesn't make sense anyway. Just give me more of Chris Rock riffing as a black cop struggling to stay afloat amongst like this precinct of bad apples. And there's your movie.
Tim, what did you think? This is the ninth installment, as we mentioned. Is that, well, has it worn out its welcome?
I think it has a little bit. Yeah. I mean, what's interesting, I mean, it's kind of building on Sean's point, like Chris Rock also came up with the idea for this installment. Like he is a fan of this series and thought up a new chapter in it, and they made the movie based on his idea. And what's interesting is that I kept expecting and sort of hoping that it would in some ways comment on the Saw franchise or kind of riff on it a little bit. You feel that a little bit in Chris Rock's performance, but it still feels very much in service of Lionsgate saying, we need to make another Saw movie so that these will continue to be popular, because there's going to be a 10th Saw film they've already talked about. And so in a lot of ways, Chris Rock and the rest of the film as a whole are beholden to this idea of, let's not mess with this formula too much. Let's extend the franchise. Let's make sure this is enough of a hit that people want to see another one. And so because of it, it's the same clever traps that we've seen in all the other Saw movies, the same amount of gore, the same amount of like focusing on like disgusting wounds up close, that type of stuff. If you are fans of that, it does it. But to me, like with a ninth version of this like franchise, I feel like it's the ninth version featuring Chris Rock. It's not that special beyond the fact that Chris Rock is in it.
Okay, up next, let's talk about Those Who Wish Me Dead, starring Angelina Jolie as an isolated forest firefighter in the Montana wilderness. One day, she crosses paths with a young boy walking through the woods, and here's a bit from the trailer.
I'm not gonna hurt you.
I wanna see where the blood's coming from.
It's not my blood.
My dad said, if anything happened, I should find someone I can trust. Are you someone I can trust?
Those men that came for your father, did you see their faces?
That's them.
You really want to die for this kid?
Okay, Tim, what is happening here?
Okay, so Angelina Jolie plays a smoke jumper. And a smoke jumper is a very sort of special type of firefighter who jumps out of planes into the midst of a forest fire. They jump into the heart of the blaze to really try and contain it and also save people who might be trapped inside. And as the movie begins, she is haunted by the fact that there was a recent forest fire in Montana where she was unable to save three people. It wasn't her fault. There was nothing she could have done. Nonetheless, she is haunted by these deaths and blames herself for what happened. Well, redemption comes in the form of her being able to possibly help this 12-year-old boy named Connor, who's played by Finn Little. And Connor's father has been killed by these two hitmen, and they're now on the hunt for this young man as well. There's a lot of different kind of elements that you see in other kind of genre films, other types of thrillers. To me, this movie doesn't entirely come together. It's a little too generic and sort of secondhand for me for it to really work.
It sort of sounds like a little bit and a very little bit like John Cassavetes' film Gloria, where Jenna Rollins is also protecting a young boy from hitmen. Sean, how did Angelina Jolie, can you compare her to Jenna Rollins?
No, you can't. I generally like to have a little believability with my movies. There's none in this movie. I didn't buy her as a sky jumper for 1 second, one frame of this movie at all. I was like, I felt like the whole time she was wearing a Halloween costume. It's a movie without logic. It's a movie without reason. The casting was poor. The writing was bad. The execution was horrible. It's all cinematic nonsense. This entire movie was totally lost in the woods without a compass. It made no sense. You had random pop-ups. Like, you're trying to convince me that Tyler Perry is the leader of these hitmen who's in all of one scene that lasts for a minute and a half. It got to the point for me where it was totally laughable.
All right, next. Our next film is called Oxygen. It's a French thriller about a woman sleeping in a cryogenic chamber who suddenly, ta-da, wakes up. The trailer is in French, so Sean, go off.
No, I'm not going to go off on this movie. I actually love this movie. I just love the premise. It's a claustrophobic survival nightmare. And I just thought the director, who's known for a great horror movie called High Tension, but more so for Crawl, which is an amazing movie, and Piranha 3D, he sort of changes it up and he doesn't work with very much. It's such a great sci-fi premise. And Melanie Laurent, who most people know from Inglourious Basterds, she delivers an incredible performance because the movie is 99.9% all her. And most of her acting is all done with just her minimal facial expressions, which she masterfully delivers on screen, because you stay glued and hooked to this movie from the beginning. Now, some of it is sort of predictable, but it does work as it slowly evolves. I mean, there's some great things about this thriller that really works, and it sort of has this computer voice who's sort of like the Hal voice from, you know, Space Odyssey, but it's just a little different and a little sort of creepier. And, you know, she's trying to communicate with this computer to figure out, how did I get here? What do I do to get out? You know, the dialogue was great. It's well written. I love this movie a lot.
Tim, what'd you think?
I was a little less enthused about it. I think that she's great in it. This woman wakes up in a cryogenic chamber and she doesn't know where she is and she doesn't know how she got there and she doesn't know who she is either. And so much of the movie is her unraveling the mystery of all of that. How did I get here? Who the heck am I? And the only thing that she can rely on is this computer voice, who one of the interesting kind of wrinkles in the film is that sometimes that voice seems to be helpful, and other times it seems to be not helpful, which adds a little kind of paranoid element to what exactly is going on. And so this character is running out of oxygen in this very tight chamber that she's in. And I think all of that stuff is actually really fun. I think the problem for me is that what is difficult is that when you have a mystery sort of set up that way, there's only so many possibilities of an explanation of what in fact is going on. And I don't think that the reveal of all that stuff is as satisfying as I would have liked, because one of the tricky things with a movie like this is it builds up its premise and its promise so much from its opening that you start to think, I wonder if it's this. I wonder if this is the answer. I think the premise is really fun. I just don't think where it ultimately goes is satisfying enough.
Okay, our final film today is called The Killing of Two Lovers. It's about a man trying to keep his family together as he and his wife separate and agree to see other people. And here's a bit from the trailer.
You think we're doing the right thing?
David, I love you. You love me. We're trying to figure this out.
Mom's cheating on you.
What's his name?
Derek.
I only agreed to do this because you promised me that we were going to work through this.
You need to fight. You need to fight for us.
Okay, Tim, this seems to be, well, an open question when you look at the title of the movie, The Killing of Two Lovers, but this is really about, I don't know, was it looking into the intricacies of what makes a marriage work or not work?
Yes. I mean, what's very tantalizing about the title is I can tell you what the opening scene is. In the opening scene, we see the main character, David, played by Clayne Crawford. He is in his family home, and he discovers that his wife is in bed with another man. He pulls out a gun, but he doesn't shoot them, but he just holds it there menacingly for longer than we would like as an audience. But then he walks away. And that's how the movie starts. And so the title is this tantalizing sort of idea that we think about throughout the rest of the movie, which is, first of all, who is this guy, David? What is he capable of? And what is ultimately going to happen? Most of the film is David trying to kind of reconcile the idea that his wife, Nikki, is seeing someone else, though he and his wife are separated. He's trying to keep the connection with his young kids. They have four kids together, and he's trying to keep that connection strong and also holding out hope that he and his wife will ultimately get back together. But that opening scene is so provocative, and the title matches it, that you keep wondering, is David going to do something incredibly violent? It's really kind of interesting and thought-provoking. It's more of an exercise than a fully successful kind of emotional experience. But in terms of that kind of interesting look at this man, it worked for me.
Sean, what did you think?
This is a great movie for a lot of reasons. I'll start with the simple first. This movie's way better than Marriage Story, way better than Kramer versus Kramer. The reason this works as a separation drama is because, number one, this movie pulls you inside of David's head. It brilliantly does that. And so the entire time you're watching the movie, he's silently trying to navigate the situations he's in. And he's basically a walking, ticking time bomb. And every second of this, you're wondering, when is he going to explode? And you're right there, that the POV is so perfectly done. But the fact that this takes place in a small town really makes this movie relatable. It's honest. It's never over the top, which is what I really love. I mean, it's just so authentic. And it's just situations that a lot of people found themselves in before
So you can totally relate to it. I just love the realism of this film. And Clayne Crawford, this is best performance I've seen in a long time. And I watch a lot of movies. I just really connected with this film in a very personal way because of the way it was executed. I actually thought it was executed flawlessly.
Wow. Okay. So definitely check out the film set in Utah, not the one set in Montana. Is basically
no, not at all.
Our takeaway from you today.
Right.
All right. Sean Edwards, film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City, also the co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association, and Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International and author of the new book, This Is How You Make a Movie. Thank you both.
Well, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Coming up, Good Foods, Evan Kleinman joins me to talk about pickling, how to do it at home. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes, Bake Off Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bad like that.
Pie.
It is that time again. That's right. Evan Kleinman is here to talk about food. She is host of KCRW's Good Food. And many of us during the pandemic, well, we DIY'd our heart out in the kitchen. We baked sourdough, homemade pizza. Maybe we even made our own condiments. Some of us did, not me. Well, today, Evan is going to help us add pickling and fermentation to our DIY repertoire. Hi, Evan.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, so what is the definition of fermented foods?
So a fermented food is something which is transformed through, for our conversation, lactic acid fermentation, which is a yeast that comes into your food because you've made a hospitable environment for it to thrive. And it ends up transforming your food in a good way so that it won't spoil. Usually this happens just from the addition of water and salt if we're talking about vegetables and pickling.
Hmm.
For example, pickles that we think of, pickled cucumbers.
Mm-hmm.
You can make them by pouring a vinegar water mixture over them, which some pickles are. But for a real dill pickle, like a deli dill pickle, those are fermented. And so for those, you just need your cucumber and a brine made of water and salt. And you mix those two together and you let it sit. And by some miracle, these little bubbles start to form and fermentation starts to happen. It's very exciting.
That is very exciting. Can you do it with any vegetable?
Pretty much. Any vegetable that has that kind of yeast on it. Obviously cabbage, i.e. sauerkraut. And the one I have grown to love and make all the time is the Korean water radish kimchi, which is not a red kimchi, it's a white kimchi, and is so beautiful and delicious and crunchy.
Mm. So this is that big, like a big white radish that you get in Asian grocery stores.
Yeah, the Korean radish has a slightly different shape than the daikon that we're used to. The daikon radish, which looks like a parsnip on steroids. Mm-hmm. Korean radishes, they have more rounded shoulders. They're shorter and a bit plumper. But you can use either one for making these pickles.
And you have a recipe for us for that.
Absolutely. And seriously, it is as simple as rubbing the sliced radish with salt, letting it sit overnight, pouring off the accumulated water and rinsing them off, and then adding what you want to flavor your pickles. I usually add onion, garlic, fresh chili, and then water. And the residual salt that's left in the radish is enough to start the fermentation. And mine, usually I leave them out of the refrigerator for maybe 2 days. And I love them when they're that young. But then you can put them in the refrigerator and they will continue to ferment. So as they sit, they get more more sour.
Mm. It really is a miracle, because here I was envisioning a complicated stew or sauce that you'd have to make to pour over these vegetables to make them taste like this. But it really is only just a few ingredients.
It's just a few ingredients. There is a traditional way of making don chimi, which is what water radish kimchi is called, that involves an Asian pear that is ground up with the water and salt. But I learned this way, and I love the taste of the broth. So what you end up with after you eat all your radishes is you still have like half a jar of liquid that is so delicious. And that is actually the base that's used for the cold noodles that we've talked about in the past, the Korean cold noodles. And I also use it for dirty martinis, Bloody Marys, and micheladas. It's just so refreshing.
Wow. I like how you can recycle it too. So that recipe is from a book called Our Korean Kitchen. Tell us about this book and who wrote it.
So this is a book that landed on the Good Food desk maybe back in 2015. It's called Our Korean Kitchen. It's written by a UK chef named Jordan Bork and his fashion designer wife, Regina Pio. And this happened to be the first recipe that I tried of don chimi, and it's just fantastic. Absolutely easy and beautiful.
Okay, on to our next recipe. And this is pickles with vinegar. So not the lacto-fermentation, but the vinegar fermentation. Yeah,
exactly. These are the zanahorias in escabeche, those pickled Mexican carrots that you get when you go to the taqueria or to your favorite Mexican restaurant. I'm addicted to those. And so I just decided I had to teach myself how to make them because I was, you know, buying too much of them. And they're so easy to make. Basically, I use, you know, whatever carrots I happen to have, from gorgeous farmer's market carrots to if I have run out and I really need them. I have even made them with bagged baby carrots. Don't think badly of me. And then I use whatever kind of onion I have. Sometimes I've used baby onions. I use sometimes red onions, sometimes white onion, sometimes yellow onion. I cut those up into quarter inch thick slices. And then jalapenos, raw jalapenos. I cut off the tops, cut them in half, and some garlic. And what I do is I make my pickling mixture with equal amounts of water and vinegar. And then my go-to spice mix is black peppercorns, some coriander seed. The must-have is dried Mexican oregano and some salt. And then I bring that to the boil. I take all my vegetables and throw them in. And when it comes back to the boil, I remove the pot from the heat, drain the vegetables with a bowl underneath to catch all of the pickling juice, put the vegetables in the jar, pour the juice over it, let it come down to room temperature, then throw it in the fridge.
What is the advantage to doing it that way, having a pickling brine versus the method that we talked about at the beginning, just letting nature take its course?
Well, I'm sure I could ferment these carrots, but if you want the taste that you get in a taqueria, then you use vinegar. It's just a different recipe.
And do you prefer one taste to the other when it comes to your pickled vegetables?
No, that's what I love about food. They're just different enough. The one made with the Korean radish, because it's fermented, has that umaminess. It's tart, but it's not tart like vinegar is tart. Mm-hmm. It's not that sharp, and it's more complex, whereas the carrots are more like, you know, a bit more one note, but equally addictive.
Basically, it's a way for a lot of places that don't have the bounty we have in the wintertime to have their vegetables in the wintertime.
Well, especially if you consider when people started to do this, which is like thousands of years ago. Yeah, I mean, it's a way of preservation, and it's a way of naturally keeping scurvy at bay.
Ah, yes. Nobody wants scurvy.
Nobody wants scurvy.
We've already gone through enough. We don't need scurvy on top of it.
Definitely.
That's Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food. You can find those recipes on our Instagram at KCRW Press Play. And Press Play is made possible thanks to Rosalie Atkinson, Michelle Aloy, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Sarah Sweeney, and Amy Taw. And also thanks to listeners like you, because member support is our single largest source of funding for KCRW, the single largest source. So you are it. You are the public in public radio, as the saying goes, and we need you to step up right now. KCRW.com/join. Become a member at $20 a month and keep KCRW as part of your future and part of our future. So donate now also, and you can win a brand new iPhone 12. So there's an incentive for you. KCRW.com/give. I'm Madeline Brand. We have a special show for you tomorrow on the 50th anniversary of NPR, the history, the future of public radio. I will see you on Monday.